Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is a syndicated show produced in the studios of CGSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
Welcome to this week's edition of Latin Waves. We speak to Dr. Donald Gustine, author of Not a Conspiracy Theory, How Business Propaganda Hijacks Democracy. He speaks about the need for progressives to win in the arena of public ideas. Stay tuned.
Cuchillo en manos de la patria, ni un cuchillo ni un rifle para nadie. La tierra es de todos como el aire. Me gustaría tener manos enormes, tener manos violentas y salvajes, para arrancar fronteras una a una y dejar de fronteras solo el aire. Que nadie tenga tierra como se tiene traje, que todos tengan tierra como se tiene el aire. Que nadie tenga tierra como se tiene traje, que todos tengan tierra como se tiene el aire. Cogería las guerras de la punta y no dejaría una en el paisaje, y abriría la tierra para todos como si fuera el aire. Que el aire no esté nadie, 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 y todos tienen su parcela de aire, y todos tienen su parcela de aire.
You are listening to Latin Waves. Latin Waves is a syndicated radio program. It airs from coast to coast in Canada and throughout the U.S. The song you just listened to is by Intacto. It really is a song of longing. It is titled Nocturno sin Patria. It means that he's talking about this deep sentiment that we all want a society that is guided by democratic principles. And what does that democratic principle mean to us? Seems to be almost homogeneous throughout countries. People want a place to live, a place where they can be peaceful, where they don't have to be accosted by war or hunger or incredible poverty, where their children have access to education, to water, to food. This seems to be a sentiment shared by nations across the globe. And yet, that doesn't seem to be what our Canadian daily newspaper newspapers reflect. That doesn't seem to be what our media reports on. So my next guest is Dr. Donald Gustin. He talks precisely about this. Why is it that these notions of what we hold most, you know, the deepest values we hold so dear to ourselves are in direct contrast to the commentaries we see reflected in our newspaper that are calling us to privatize our healthcare, privatize our social institutions, to cut social spending. So in his book, Not a Conspiracy Theory, How Business Propaganda Hijacks Democracy, Professor Gustin talks about what are some of these issues that are sort of co-opting our narrative of who we are as a people. We're very privileged to have him on our show. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you very much for asking me.
Now, your book has been well-researched. You spend a great deal of time looking at the way we draft a narrative of who we are as a people. So I'll ask you to give a brief summary of how has, you know, thinkers like Friedrich Hayek and Milton Friedman, what role have they played in the drafting of the narrative that right now has completely co-opted the values of democracy and have transformed it into something that doesn't seem to reflect what the needs of our population are?
Okay, well, that's a big question, but let me just try and summarize it briefly. I'd say we have to go back till just around the end of the Second World War, when thinkers like Hayek and Friedman were concerned about the values of social justice and welfare state that were coming to be universal around the world. And they were firm believers in the market. In fact, they think that if you have a well-functioning market, you don't need democracy. So they thought, well, we need to gain political power to reverse these social justice and economic justice gains, but we can't do that because of the prevailing climate of ideas that were circulating around the world. So they set out to change the climate of ideas, and the way they did that was by setting up these seemingly arm's-length think tanks like the Fraser Institute. There's hundreds of them around the world today, and what the think tanks do is that they package the ideology of neoliberalism, let's call it that because that's kind of a commonly accepted term, they package the ideology in what seems to be research. So like to take a current example here in Canada, in British Columbia, the school report card that the Fraser Institute turns out every year after year, repetition being one aspect of propaganda, the repeated often and enough, it becomes part of the prevailing background of ideas, so that it's not really research, but it looks like research so that they can sell the ideology of getting government out of education and turning it over to the non-profit and private sectors. So that's been what they've done for 50 years, and I think they've been quite successful. I think progressive people have woken up late in the day to find out what's been going on, and I'm sort of happy to see that people are starting to talk about this more and starting to talk about what they can do to regain the ideas that you were talking about in your introduction.
Central to this narrative of the market can do it better, the privatization as the exemplary notion of democratic rights. Yes. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the instruments that have enabled the business sector to co-opt this deep ingrained value that we have of freedom and that we identify. And right now it has seemed the freedom of choice. Those with more money have more choice. So could you talk a little bit about what instruments have enabled them to co-opt this
idea? Okay, I didn't have this in my book, but I've thought of it since, is that Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech in 1963 when he talked about the oasis of freedom and justice. And at that time, we believed that they went together. People have to be free, but there also has to be a dominant value of justice in a society, social justice, environmental justice, economic justice. And what they did, what the thinkers like Friedman and Hayek and the thousands of others, is they drove a wedge between freedom and justice. And they sanctified freedom. And as you point out, like, freedom is a very noble value that we all hold dear, but they turned it into freedom to choose, and freedom to choose which school your kids will go to, freedom to buy this or that product. And they demonized justice, so that today social justice is the enemy, and anybody like human rights commissions, anybody who advocates for equality rights, are attacked viciously. And how they've done that is through the scholars, the network of scholars. One book I've just looked at calls them the neoliberal thought collective. And they are scholars in the developed world, but also like in South America, Africa, Asia. They keep in touch, and they work off each other's ideas. And then they have their think tanks in each country that impress those ideas on the local populations. So I think over time, repetition, finding weaknesses in government programs and services and exploiting those, they've been really successful in moving their agenda forward.
I wanted to point out, just as you were talking, the incredible role the institutions, like academic institutions, have in propagating this worldview, right? A worldview of the market as supreme. And also, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the connection that we are left with, the idea that the wealthy have the right to lie to us, to deceive us, because it is in our own interest, that the people are denied even the idea that we could decide for ourselves. How has that evolved? And can you give us some examples in which these entities working with their own tin tags are not only co-opting the message, but are implementing clear policies that are not only harmful, but are detrimental to our society? And I'm thinking of examples that you use in your book, uh-huh. For instance, with relation to the tobacco industry and others, examples that you point to in your book.
Okay, yeah. Well, I think people deciding for themselves, like public participation in the decisions of our society and in establishing policies, these represent an enormous threat to business and to business profits, because if people decided, well, business has way too much power and we need to have firmer regulation and higher taxes, business hates that and will do anything it needs to prevent that from happening. So going after democratic institutions is certainly one way to do that. And the idea of the think tank is that it's supposed to be arm's length, independent, nonpartisan, you know, whatever they call it. But the fact is that none of these think tanks, like the Fraser Institute, would exist without the financial backing of big business and the foundations of conservative, wealthy businessmen. And in my book, I have the one example that rarely does the Fraser Institute tell you where its money comes from. There was this 1998 master settlement agreement between the United States Attorneys General and the big tobacco companies. The tobacco companies had to pay something like $305 billion in penalties to reimburse states for their increased health costs as a result of disease due to smoking, cancer, and heart disease. But another part of the settlement was that the tobacco companies had to turn over all the documents that were used in any court cases involving tobacco companies up till the end of 2010. So documents are still being added. But I came across a set of letters written by the Fraser Institute's Michael Walker to the research director of British American Tobacco. They own Imperial Tobacco here in Canada, the largest tobacco company, and Brown and Williamson in the U.S., and subsidiaries all around the world. And Walker was asking the tobacco company for $100,000 a year so that they could go after what he called the risk activists. And these are people who wanted to regulate smoking, you know, so that secondhand smoke didn't affect people who weren't smokers. And so he wanted to attack those people who were trying to achieve those kind of regulations. So that was a real insight into who they are and what they're trying to achieve.
Now, you talk in your book about how this right turn has taken place from the 1970s onwards. We have seen a libertarian message of deregulation and lowering taxes, particularly for corporations. We've seen in Canada, we have the lowest corporate tax in any of the GA countries, which is shameful. And at the same time, here in BC, we're seeing a massive drive to privatization. Privatization not only in healthcare, in education, the deliberate privatization of institutions that are money creation machines for our society, like BC Hydro, BC Rails, you know, the sale of BC Rail that's now silent. So what can people do? Because it seems that, you know, business has the industrial arm, right? They can take their jobs and send them somewhere else. They also have the academic institutions who perpetuate that message of the market as the ideal form of organizing ourselves. So where do we citizens wanting to transform the society find alternatives? How do we change that?
Okay, well, there's a lot of things. There's, on every issue, there's people fighting the privatization of BC Hydro and fighting to protect the integrity of public education, fighting to save Medicare, and all of those issues are going on. Plus, one part of the system that I didn't really talk about so far, maybe we should, is that the role of the media in disseminating the ideas that the think tanks package. Like, without the media, corporate propaganda is not possible. So we could talk about that, but all we're seeing the emergence of all kinds of alternative media, like here in BC, the TIE and Rabble.ca and lots of others, where alternative messages, alternative visions are being created. So that can go on today and is going on, and hope it continues and picks up steam. But I also need to step back a bit and say, how did this happen? It happened over the long term by working to change a climate of ideas. You know, like, we could vote in the NDP or whatever party you considered progressive, but they still have to operate within the prevailing climate of ideas. So, like, in the U.S., the advice to Barack Obama is, you're too far to the left, you need to move to the center. Whereas in the 70s, the right said, well, we're not going to move to the center, we're going to stay on the right, and we're going to create a critical mass of ideas on the right. And that's what they did. They pulled everything over to them. We need to start pulling things back. And so that's going to take a much longer-term perspective, finding progressive scholars, of which there are many. In fact, in the universities, there's way more progressive scholars than there are conservative ones. It's just that the conservative ones have the marketing machines of the Fraser Institute to distribute their work, whereas the progressive scholars, they just kind of talk to each other. So that needs to change. There's progressive think tanks like the Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives. That needs to be supported and needs to create more alliances with other kind of progressive groups. And I think gradually over time, momentum can be built up to start to get progressive social justice type of ideas back into the climate and gradually switch it back. But it's a long-term process. It's not going to change overnight.
I love that you point out that the voices of progressive are many. They just seem to be blocked by the media, and they're being blocked by their, you know, the financial power that backs this right-wing institutions.
Yes, that's right.
I wonder if you could talk in terms of, you know, concrete examples of things that people can do. Because I always think that, you know, there's something everyone can do. We all have capacities, you know, that are perhaps unique or very similar to others. If people could do one thing today to start to begin that process, you know, talking about it, I think, is one key example. But for people who read your book, what would they draw from it? What inspiration would you hope they draw from it?
The first thing that is None of this happened by accident. You know, the media talk about how globalization just happened and neoliberalism just happened, but it didn't happen. My book shows a carefully conceived, thought-out, strategized, systematic approach that they've taken over many years. So that's the one lesson. That doesn't necessarily lead to action. There's just so many things that people can do on all fronts, whether it's environmental or anti-poverty or human rights or whatever. There's so many ways that people can just get involved in any issue. I'm not sure which one is more important than another one.
And I think that's important, right, that one doesn't supersede the other, that whatever we do moves us forward in the direction of creating public spaces, of protecting healthcare, of protecting education, or protecting our social and public institutions, I think.
Yes. You know.
How can people access your book?
They could buy it. $23, People's Co-op Bookstore on Commercial Drive, or else the big chains have it too. I know all the libraries have it, and they could certainly get it out of the any local library. I'm pretty sure they all have it. So that would be one way. And I've written a few excerpts have been posted on the TAI website and also rabble.ca, so they could find those on those websites.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for being with us and leaving us. What inspires you? What inspires you to keep struggling? Even, you know, we all face obstacles sometimes, but what keeps you inspired that, in other words, not only possible, it's already being put in place?
Well, I got really angry when I saw what was going on and the free ride that the media were giving these guys. And that keeps me going, is to sort of just shine a spotlight on what they're doing, on what the media are doing. And I'm also very encouraged by seeing, like, groups like the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives and other organizations starting to talk about things like framing. How do we frame issues? Why have we let them capture the framing for healthcare, for public education? We need to come up with our own frame. So, like, I'm very excited about working, and let's say in the area of public education, the Fraser Institute school ranking is applying a frame of choice, freedom and choice. I'm free to choose which school my kids can go to, and that's great for you. But what about public education as a democratic institution? We need another frame. So I'm very excited to work on things like that with teachers and with education professionals to try and come up with a frame that can challenge their frame.
That's beautiful. Thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Take care.
Bye.
That was Professor Donald Gutstein. He is my guest. He is the author of Not a Conspiracy Theory, How Business Propaganda Hijacks Democracy. And I think that his last point was so important, because if we're asking, if the question is always about choice instead of what is the intent of education? Is education intent to move us forward as a society, to create a society of understanding, of cohesion, where we can work together and really create a world that is reflective of our human dignity, of our immense capacity? We forget that we have so much capacity, and we diminish our humanity when we adjust to an unjust system that leaves so many out, that leaves so many millions of people as disposable people, as the disposable cogs to be treated and exploited, as Graham Russell pointed out, as Eve Zingler has illustrated for us. That has to stop, and it can stop only when we decide that it's time to stop, when we decide and really look at our institutions. What do they mean to us, and what really is the intent of those institutions? do we want an education that is that can enable us to liberate ourselves and create something more egalitarian and on principles of fairness, or do we want to just keep going with the status quo? I think the answer is facing us.
We have come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is a weekly syndicated program produced and broadcast from the studios of CGSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. The program is available free of charge to campus and community stations across Canada and the U.S. For more information about our work or to support our efforts, please visit our website at www.latinwavesmedia.com. Bye for now.